Chapter 5. But sleep did not come easy that night. Between disjointed dreams, there flashed onto the cinema screen in Edith's head short audio-visual messages which she should later have to decode. The fine ankles, the unexpected evening pumps of the man in grey. His decision, at some forgotten point, to fold that unconvincing newspaper, to get up, stretch himself slightly, and follow a colleague into the bar. The unusual sound of merriment that was perceptible even across the width of the salon from the direction of the bar. The emergence from the bar an hour later of the woman with the dog, helpless with laughter and somewhat dishevelled, her arms linked into those of the man in grey and his friend. Kiki's tiny head reined mournfully at this apostasy, his spherical body attempting to bar her path. A mild altercation between Monsieur Hubert and his son-in-law at this sight. The nervous withdrawal of the pianist, his placating smile all round, to which only Madame Bonneuil responded with a slight nod. This information remained in many ways obscure. She was not sure whether she had in fact remained downstairs to witness the scenes which came to her mind, or whether, in some overactive recess of her brain, she was making them up. She was aware that her night was agitated, that the only alternative to waking up was to undergo more of these strange sequences, half dream, half memory. Everything seemed vivid, potent with significance, but the significance was hidden. She stretched uneasily, a pioneer of her troubled sleep. Somewhere, at some level of consciousness, she heard a door close. When she woke, rather later than usual, it was with an ancient and deadly foreknowledge that the day would be a write-off. Her broken night had left her with an aching head, an instinctive shrinking from both food and company. Minute noises seemed magnified. A trolley was wheeled vigorously along the corridor, and the high voices of the maids sounded unbearably piercing as she took her bath, feeling as unwieldy as an invalid. She drilled herself into the regime of prudence. Depression hovered and must be forestalled. Writing was out of the question. Taking things very, very quietly, she counselled herself, do not think. Close doors. The pulled curtains revealed another brilliant day. The mountains with a thin seam of snow, as clear as it were, as if it were metres away. Traffic seemed to be in abeyance. A different sort of activity was underway. Outside, in the garden, waiters in clean white jackets placed small chairs and tables beneath the glass awning of the terrace and were even now discussing the advisability of drawing down the orange blinds to palliate the heat of the sun, already palpable through the glass. Somewhere in the distance, a toneless bell struck. Sunday, she thought with surprise. Contingency plans, of the sort of which she had become adept, were called for. Perhaps she could simply sit in the sun and read. She was not likely to be disturbed. Contingency plans were no doubt at that very moment being perfected in other rooms. She imagined the conversations. Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer would be ordering the car to take them out somewhere. Perhaps she imagined a scenic drive culminating in a gourmet lunch. The men from Geneva would get together for some sort of excursion, perhaps across the lake to Evian. Madame de Bonneuil would be one of the few to stay, reading and silent as usual. The tall, thin beauty with the dog was never visible in the daytime, and it was impossible to imagine her doing anything except eating ice cream and smoking. Like a child on an exalt from school, Edith thought it entirely probable that she would have the day to herself, a prospect which she most welcomed. Embroiled in her fictional plot, the main purpose of which was to distance those all too real circumstances over which she could exert no control. She felt a weariness that seemed to preclude any enthusiasm, any initiative, any relaxation. Fiction, the time-honoured resource of the ill at ease, would have to come to her aid. But the choice of a book presented some difficulties, since when she was writing she could only read something she had read before, and in her exhausted state, a febrile agitation, invisible to the naked eye, tended to distance even the very familiar. Words became distorted. Pear, for instance, would become fear. She dreaded making noises, nonsense of something precious to her, and regretfully disqualified Henry James. Nothing too big would do, nothing too small suffice. In any event, her attention was fragmented. In the end, she picked up a volume of short stories, the beautifully named Ces plaisirs qu'on nomme à la légère physique. Colette, that sly old fox, would, she trusted, see her through. Silence reigned on the taverns, although it was not empty. At one end sat Madame de Bonneuil, wearing a beige dress and jacket, slightly stained in the front, and battered beige hat, her stick planted between her legs. She kept her eyes fixed on the road, a large brown bag placed in readiness on the table beside her. At the other end, entirely silent, stretched out on a chaise longue, and immobile behind very large glasses, lay the woman with the dog. The beautiful day had within it the seeds of its own fragility. It was the last day of summer. Sun burned out of a cloudless blue sky. Asters and dahlias stood immobile in the clear light, a light without glare, without brilliance. Trees had already lost the dark, heavy foliage of what had been an exceptional August and early September, and were all the more poignant for the dryness of their yellowing leaves which floated noiselessly down from time to time. Stepping out of the salon, Monsieur Hubert rubbed his hands with pleasure. There would be many occasional visitors for lunch and tea today, but at the moment all was quiet. Nobody spoke. The only sound was the occasional fall of a chestnut. The man in grey, dressed today in something paler and even more elegant, with, Edith was delighted to note, a Panama hat in his hand, stepped out into the garden and surveyed the scene. Catching sight of the woman with the dog, he went across to her, bent over her supine body, and made some apparently jocular inquiry. A weak rising of a very white arm and a long limp hand were his answer. Nodding to Edith and also to Madame de Bonneuil, the man in grey departed on business on his own, his occasional and secret smile once again in evidence. As he rounded the corner, with the dog shot upright, leaned into Edith's direction and whispered urgently, I say, I'm sorry, I don't know your name. Could you be an angel and come and sit with me? I don't want that man around me again today, and I simply can't put him off with making a scene, which I've half a mind to do, I can assure you. Obediently, and with only the mildest of lingering regrets, Edith closed her book and moved close along the terrace, placing herself on a small chair at the end of the chaise longue. Such a lovely, peaceful day, she thought. Oh, well, at least she hasn't got the dog with her. Monica, said the woman, extending her narrow, boneless hand. Edith, said Edith, shaking it cautiously. Better not to get too far, she said to herself. I've been wondering about you, said Monica. I've wanted to talk to you, but you've always been with that Ma Pusley, and I can't stand the sight of her. Where is she? Asked Edith, wishing that the other would lower her voice. She half expected Miss Pusey to materialise, clothed in white samite, mystic, wonderful, to restore her own sense of order and hierarchy, and also to inaugurate the day's legitimate distractions. God knows. At least they can't be out buying knickers today. Oh, I beg your pardon. Lingerie. She pronounced the word with an exaggerated French accent, although I wouldn't put it past her to wake someone up and get them to open the shop just because she happened to have a couple of thousand spare francs about her. There does seem to be a great deal of money, murmured Edith, in what she hoped was a neutral tone. Servants must feel like this, she reflected, gossiping below stairs. Loaded, said the other. Trade, of course. Darling Daddy left them a packet. Wine, she added, responding to Edith's curiosity. He was a sherry importer, And the funniest thing is, the old girl can't stand the taste of it. She only likes champagne. Well, who doesn't? Edith remembered the last occasion on which she had drunk champagne, shuddering. "Anything wrong?" asked Monica. "Oh, I'm tired," thought Edith. "I must be careful. I am not going to confide in this languid and luxurious woman, who would in any case be bored if I did. Light conversation is all that is called for." "Oh, I'm fine," she said. "But where's Kiki?" Monica's face fell. "In disgrace. Locked in the bathroom." "Well, you can't expect a little dog like that to behave as well as he would with his own things around him. And the Swiss hate dog. That's what's wrong with him, if you ask me." "Have you been here long?" asked Edith. "Ages," sighed Monica. "I'm here for my health." "Oh, I'm sorry. Have you been ill?" "No," replied the other. "Look, let's have some coffee, shall we?" She summoned a shadowy waiter with an imperious hand. "It's so nice to have someone to talk to," she said. She seemed to be recovering a long-lost animation by the second, and when the coffee arrived, poured it out largely and carelessly, although she took only one sip from her cup and almost immediately lit an immensely long cigarette with a lighter that sprung into a 2-inch flame. Everything about her seemed exaggerated. Her height, the length of her extraordinary fingers, her carrying voice, her huge oyster-coloured eyes, today slightly bloodshot. Edith could see behind her dark glasses. A breakdown, she decided. A bereavement. Tread carefully. Monica nodded towards the cigarette. Forbidden, of course. Strict instructions. To hell with it. She inhaled deeply, as if about to submerge into several fathoms of water. After a few seconds, two plumes of smoke emerged from perfect nostrils. A patch on the lung, perhaps, thought Edith, revising. And how beautiful she is. I had not thought so before. The sound of wheels on gravel brought their heads round. Madame de Bonneuil, her pug face creased into a smile, was struggling to her feet. A car door banged and a man walked jauntily into the garden, followed by a woman in a red dress, the spikes of her high-heel sandals plunging into the lawn. "Eh bien, maman," cried the man, falsely cheerily. Kisses were exchanged. "Poor old trout," said Monica, her tone very slightly lower. "She lives for that son. She'd do anything for him. And he comes to see her once a month, takes her out in the car, brings her back, and forgets about her." "Why is she here?" asked Edith. Monica shrugged. "His idea entirely. He considers her manner too rustic for her to be allowed to live under the same roof as that frightful wife of his. Incidentally, started life as a hairdresser before snuffling her first husband. This one's her second. Madame de Bonneuil had a beautiful house near the French border. It's quite a good family, incidentally. Naturally, the daughter-in-law wanted the house to herself, so the old girl had to go. She can't stand the wife, of course, despises her. Quite right. She lives here because she doesn't want to see the son unhappy." "How do you know all this?" asked Edith, startled and impressed. "She told me," said Monica, inhaling from another cigarette. "I've never heard her say a single word," mused Edith. "Well, it's difficult for her." To Edith's inquiring glance, Monica replied, "She's stone deaf. What a life." They watched the man and his wife manoeuvre Madame de Bonneuil into the back of the car. A regrettable pair, thought Edith. The man was chunkily built, swarthy with dark glasses. He looked like a croupier, off duty until nightfall. The wife was much younger, black hair, voluptuous, expensive. She will marry yet again, thought Edith, as the car drove off. Then perhaps Madame de Bonneuil can go home. But it seemed unlikely. Monica, she reflected later as they strolled slowly along the lake shore, knows far more than I do. It is right that she resembles a sphinx. The morning had passed quite pleasantly in her company, but she was puzzled by Monica's insistence that they visit the cafe for more coffee and cakes. "It's nearly lunchtime," she protested. A fleeting, oblique look across Monica's face. "Oh, come on," she begged. "It's Sunday, and I'm sick of that awful fish." Watching Monica plunging a resolute fork into an eclair, Edith reflected with some humility that she was not good at human nature. She could make up characters, but she could not decipher those in real life. For the conduct of life, she required an interpreter, and this woman was very pleasant indeed, although apt, she could see, to cause dissension. Monsieur Hubert had frowned when he saw her veer off in the direction of the café, Edith in her wake. "The one I can't make out," said Edith shamelessly, as Monica leaned back and sucked smoke hungrily from yet another cigarette, "is Jennifer." Monica's fine oval eyes emptied of all expression. "Jennifer," she pronounced, and after a pause, "Jennifer, I assure you, is entirely straightforward." Edith, glancing at her watch, saw that it was nearly 1 o'clock, and "we must go," she said firmly. Monica's face dropped into its habitual lines of obstinate gloom. "No dramatics, please," thought Edith. "Come," she said, stretching out her hand, as the other sat there immobile, shoulders hunched. "You are much more beautiful when you smile, and it's such a lovely day. Won't you walk back with me?" Slowly, reluctantly, Monica allowed herself to be led to the door, and a small smile not quite brought to birth. "A mystery here," thought Edith. When they got back to the Hôtel du Lac, they found Miss Pusey and Jennifer sitting on the terrace with the unknown man in the Panama hat. A bottle of champagne lolled in a bucket on the table. "There she is," called Mrs. Pusey in her musical voice. "Come and join us, dear. We've been looking for you." She ignored Monica, who pursed her lips, donned her glasses, and flung herself disdainfully onto the chaise longue. Edith, annoyed on behalf of her new friend, hesitated, but was saved by the appearance of a waiter, napkin over his arm in the doorway. Mrs. Pusey, who was indeed in white, saw them and became intent on the business of leveraging herself out of her chair. The man in the Panama hat offered his arm, and, with Jennifer holding her mother's jacket, they proceeded into the dining room. "Come on, Monica," urged Edith, but Monica pulled down the corners of her mouth, raised a limp hand again, and then, to all intent and purposes, fell asleep. The afternoon continued, golden and mellow. The beauty of this perfect day brought them all back to the terrace, where Edith, to whom Monica presented a stony profile and tightly shut eyes, joined the Pusleys and the man with the Panama hat, who was introduced as Mr. Neville. An hour passed quietly, for Mr. Neville had procured an English Sunday newspaper from some unknown source and had kindly passed them round. But Mrs. Pusey, after flicking distractedly through the pages of the colour supplement, gave a sigh and said, "Such an ugly world. Greed and sensationalism, cheap sex and no taste. Not a sign. Run upstairs and get my book, would you, darling?" "Yes," she went on, as Edith and Mr. Neville made polite but sustained efforts to ignore the interruption. "I'm afraid I'm a romantic." With this pronunciation, she smiled at them, as reluctantly they surrendered the Observer, the Sunday Times, the Sunday Telegraph. "You see, I was brought up to believe in the right values." "Here we go," thought Edith, swallowing a tiny yaw. "Love means marriage to me," pursued Mrs. Pusey. "Romance and courtship go together. A woman should be able to make a man worship her." Mr. Neville inclined his head, giving polite consideration to this view. "Well, perhaps I've been fortunate," Mrs. Pusey added with a little laugh, looking down to rearrange the bow of her silk blouse. "My husband worshipped me." "Thank you, darling," she said as Jennifer handed her the paper back with the straining Art Nouveau profile on the cover. "This is the sort of story I enjoy," she went on. She was able to talk even when she was reading, Edith noted. "The Sun at Midnight," pronounced Mr. Neville gravely, "by Vanessa Wilde. Not a writer known to me," he said to Edith, watching her profile as she gazed distantly over the lake. "Although I don't think this is one of her best," says Mrs. Pusey. Edith felt an author's pang. I was quite pleased with that one, she thought. David was on his summer holiday, she remembered, lying fretfully on a Greek beach with his wife. "I imagined him to having a marvellous time, and I wrote for 10 hours a day to stop myself thinking of him. I was rather proud of myself. 3 years ago already." as her colour faded and her eyes took on their haze of reminiscence. "You need glasses, Edith," Penelope would say. Mr. Neville leaned forward. "After I'd ordered tea for the ladies," he said, "I wonder if you'd care to walk a little. It is a good day, not to waste. We may not get another like it." Edith paused. "Yes, you go, dear," said Mrs. Pusey, in a remote voice, as if to signify the intensity of her reading. "I expect we'll see you after dinner." A crowded day, thought Edith, gratefully for the silence of her companion, and they walked slowly away from the little town, along the water edge. The castle, dour, grim, and reverberative silhouette, a corrective to the dazzle of the water, occupied a split of land which advanced into the lake as if to impede further progress. Soon it would obliterate the sun, and its massive shape would darken and seem to advance towards them. Instinctively they stopped, unwilling to witness this ritual extinction, and turned to the parapet over which they leaned. The day was very slowly losing its colour, the blue of the sky whitening that neutral hour which signifies the end of the afternoon. The sadness that comes with the approach of the evening stole over Edith. Her companion glanced at her. "Shall we sit down for a moment?" he suggested, guiding her to a stone bench, crossing his elegant ankles and asking her permission to light a small cigar. "Now, Miss Wolfe," he said, "I don't believe we've been properly introduced. Philip Neville," he added calmly. Edith shot him a sharp glance for the first time, registering his existence above ankle level and the profile usually presented to her as he gave his attention to Mrs. Pusey. "Or may I call you Vanessa Wilde?" he went on. For the first time in weeks, Edith laughed. The sound so long unheard surprised her. Once started, she couldn't stop. Mr. Neville surveyed her with a pleased expression. A submerged gust found their way to the surface. Finally, he joined in, his smile lingering whilst Edith wiped her eyes. "Now that, if I may say so, was considerable improvement on your usual expression." Edith looked at him in surprise. "I wasn't aware that anyone was interested in my expression," she said. "I rather thought I was useful as an audience, but only as a lay figure is useful to a painter. Both can be put aside when no longer required." "And you think of yourself as a lay figure?" "No, that is how others think of me." "And you are required to be seen and not heard?" "I am required to listen and not speak." "Then for someone who is not speaking, you are giving away volumes of information." "I was not aware." "How stately you are. I don't mean that you can be seen to be moping and mowing. I don't imagine you do much of that." "Don't be too sure," said Edith, suddenly sombre. "No, no, I don't perceive you as a distracted being. I mean that if I were younger and more trendy, I should probably say that I could deconstruct the signifiers of your discourse." Edith gave a grudging smile. "That's better. I should say that you were rather bored." The mindless, the approximate kindness of this remark brought a flush to her cheeks. She took a deep and steady breath, then, her eyes brilliant, she nodded at him. "Quiet," he said. "Quiet. Then I suggest we go out one day soon. Do you know the hills in the south of us?" She shook her head. "Wine-growing country," he said, "and there are some very good restaurants. I'll telephone you if I may." They retraced their steps to the hotel. On the terrace, Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer were about to take their leave. Non-committal gestures were exchanged. Of Monica, there was no sign. Madame de Bonneuil, her smile now tinged with anxiety, sat whilst her son and daughter-in-law discussed matters common only to themselves in loud voices which she could not hear. Finally, her son responded to the cocked head of an "Oh, on s'en va" from his wife, stood up with alacrity and prepared to leave. His wife ordered her cheek to her mother-in-law and offered her cheek to her mother-in-law and tripped off to the car. Madame de Bonneuil attempted to retain her son, But the car horn sounded, and "J'arrive," he called, kissing his mother noisily on both cheeks. Madame de Bonneuil remained standing on the terrace, gazing in the direction of her vanishing son, until the silence in which she spent her days was palpable, even to Edith and Mr. Neville. That evening at dinner, at a solitary table, Edith felt her smile returning from time to time. She drank her coffee with the Puseys and made her excuses early. She was, in effect, pleasantly tired and somewhat more content than Jennifer, than usual. "Jennifer," urged Mrs. Pusey, "do ask that nice Mr. Neville to come and join us, all on his own, poor man." But Mr. Neville could and would look after himself, thought Edith, and made her way smiling to the door. There was a moon, she noticed, opening her thick curtains and stepping out onto the balcony, and the air was like milk. She sat for a while, turning many thoughts over in her mind. A beautiful night, calm, calmer than most. She felt well, and when she eventually moved inside to the mirror to brush her hair, she thought, "I shall sleep better tonight." But a sharp scream from the door and a sound of running feet startled her into awareness of danger. She listened, motionless, ancient fears awakening. Silence. Opening her door cautiously, she saw light streaming from the Pusey's suite and heard voices. Oh God, she thought, a heart attack, and willed herself to take charge. It was Jennifer's door that opened, and Jennifer herself, the straps of her satin nightgown slipping from her plump shoulders, laughing and uttering little moans, was poised on her bed, her legs drawn up. Her mother, in a pale pink silk kimono, stood in the doorway, her hand on her mouth. In the corner, crouching, Mr. Neville, busying himself with a newspaper, then went to the window and flung something out. "Quite safe now," he pronounced. "No more spiders." And he raised his eyes briefly to Edith. Mrs. Pusey came forward and laid her hand on his arm. "How can we thank you?" she breathed. "She's been terrified of spiders ever since she was tiny." But she was not tiny now, reflected Edith, whose mind had photographed an impression of Jennifer that it had not previously entertained. An obelisk, she thought, and the nightgown revealed quite a lot of very grown-up flesh. In the corridor, she waved good-night to Mr. Neville, whose secret smile was once again in place. Later that night, Kiki, waking up from his long convalescence and feeling hungry, set up a plaint which continued until dawn. Drifting off into final sleep, Edith thought she heard a door close.